If the leaders of the church are corrupt, should we continue to attend? Welcome to Good Word, a weekly radio program which explores issues of faith. Our current series focuses on Old Testament couples. My name is Paul Dibdahl, and my conversation partners today are Zdravko Stefanovic, professor of the Old Testament, and Carl Kosart, professor of the New Testament. And we are all three colleagues in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
The title of our lesson is Elkanah and Hannah, Fulfilling a Vow. And it's drawn from the first couple of chapters of the book, 1 Samuel. In a sense, Hannah and Elkanah are one of the lesser-known couples that we've looked at in this series. They're known not so much for their own accomplishments, but for their son, who was Samuel, the prophet, and the priest, I should say, as well. Mm-hmm. The story, as it begins in 1 Samuel, we are right away alerted to tension in the family because Elkanah, although he's presented as a godly man, he has two wives, and one of those women, Peninnah, has children, and the other, Hannah, does not. Now, in the Old Testament world, the ability to bear children, especially sons, was seen as a sign of God's blessing and his favor. If that's the case, then what would it mean to be childless?
God had not blessed you.
Yes, that's how the people would perceive the situation.
And since that was the case, then how would Peninnah have thought of herself, and how would she have viewed Hannah?
What an opportunity for good self-esteem on her part. God's blessed her. She's a virtuous woman, where for Hannah it would not be so well.
Would we say that her perception, Peninnah's perception, was accurate? Is that really the case, that she was favored by God and Hannah was not? Was Peninnah somehow spiritually superior to Hannah?
Not necessarily. We do gather from Hannah's prayer later on that there were tensions between the two. There was rivalry. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say much about Peninnah because it's not clear from the text.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It wouldn't be fair. Right. It wouldn't be fair to assume too much.
What would be the contemporary equivalent of bearing a son? In other words, in our day, are there things that we recognize as, wow, if that has occurred, then we know that God has shown his favor? Or where we would think we know that God has shown his favor. Is there any kind of modern equivalent to bearing a son, where we could, again, sort of pat ourselves on the back and say, wow, I must be doing it right because God has blessed me in this way?
In our society, I think income is a big one, right?
Getting a good job.
Getting a job, income, those kind of things.
Career.
You're climbing the ladder, as it were. Evidence is a blessing, but if you get a lowly paying job, then maybe something's wrong. I mean, this is the name it claim it type religion we see on television often.
Social acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would we say that these are good indicators of God's blessing?
No.
Okay.
We find in many places in the Bible that people who were faithful to God very often pay the price for it. Mm. And the psalmist complains to God that very often people who do not trust in God are prosperous, whereas the righteous suffers and feels oppressed.
Okay. And this may seem like a somewhat minor point here as we begin, but I think in contemporary society, again, if we were to turn on our TVs on a weekend morning, Sunday morning, we may find a very different message being preached about prosperity and wealth as indicators, good indicators of God's blessing, and that if we don't possess those things, that somehow God is not, we don't live under God's favor. And I think it's important to establish, at least my view, and I think it's the Bible's view as well, that that is not necessarily the case. And Zdravko, you just
And the Apostle Paul said that he learned to be content in prosperity and also when he was in poverty.
One of the fascinating parts of the story of Elkanah and Hannah, by the way, Hannah goes to the temple and she prays. God hears her prayer. She has a son. It's always been touching to me. She prays for something that then she intends to give back to God. And I've thought how different my prayers tend to be. I tend to be asking God to bless me with things that I can then somehow keep. She asks for something that she might return it to God. And in this case, it's a son, Samuel, that God blesses her.
And you think too, and I'm sure that eyebrows must be raised too in that regards to that, because it's not in the sense that, I mean, she gave him back, which meant giving him back to the temple, which was at that time very corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to be that, you know, you'd think that being at home would have been a far better environment for her little boy, but yet she gives him to the temple.
Uh-huh. She returns him to the temple. And as you just said, Carl, corrupt temple.
Why don't we read a few verses
sure.
to show what the problem was? Eli's sons were wicked men, and Eli was the high priest.
Eli was the high priest. His two sons worked there in the sanctuary.
That's right. They had no regard for the Lord. Now it was the practice of the priests with the people that whenever anyone offered a sacrifice, and while the meat was being boiled, the servant of the priest would come with a three-pronged fork in his hand. He would plunge it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself whatever the fork brought up. This is how they treated all the Israelites who came to Shiloh. But even before the fat was burned, the servant of the priest would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give the priest some meat to roast. He won't accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." If a man said, "Let the fat be burned up first, and then take whatever you want," the servant would then answer, "No, hand it over now. If you don't, I'll take it by force."
Okay. 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse mm-hmm. 12 through 14.
That's mm-hmm. correct.
Uh-huh. They were treating the Lord's offering, the text says, with contempt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yet, and here's the question, and yet Hannah brings her child to that situation. Hannah and Elkanah continue to come to offer sacrifices there, to worship there. How should we relate to a religious institution that may be led by corrupt leaders? How do we respond when offerings are treated with contempt or mishandled in some way?
This is really an important question, I think. And to me, it's just the amazing nature. And I mentioned this earlier. I want to mention it again. She has the promised child, right? And it's 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 11. She leaves him at the temple, and then we see these verses describing that.
Mm-hmm.
This is what she would have seen when she went to the temple. And very clearly, I think that the gut reaction would be, you made the wrong choice. go to a different temple. Go someplace else, because how can you worship at a temple that's corrupt?
Mm-hmm.
Yet they do, and that's mm-hmm. the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that she's using the quality time that is given to her. She refuses even to go to the required annual feasts, you know, to the sanctuary. And
yes.
she said, "No, I'm going to stay with the child, take good care of him. And then once I bring him to the temple, I will leave him there to the sanctuary, you mm-hmm. know, to the place of worship.
Mm-hmm.
So we see here, you know, that she was intentional in raising this child really to give him a good education and completely dedicate him to the Lord. She takes time for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The question, though, remains, doesn't it? How do we relate to religious organizations or institutions that we see as having difficulties, leaders who may not always do what is right, where there may be even patterns of misuse of sacrifices or of offerings that are given?
Well, I think the case of how we relate is very obvious. If you've been around the church very much time at all, where, let alone corruption, just differences of opinion. We decide not to support financially. We decide not to support by our attendance. And maybe even, you know, work to undermine certain ministries that are taking place. Yet that's not the pattern we see in this story.
Yeah. And is this story an exception? should we not draw lessons from this, that we should continue to support even a system of worship where there's corruption and so forth?
Well, here is one example. It's not about a place of worship, but not long ago I talked to a young man and asked him if he would consider going to a Christian school. And he said, no, what's the difference? Because that school has a number of problems and so on. And I responded by answering, what about taking that as a challenge, going there and becoming an agent of change?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a challenge. I don't know why I said that, but I felt impressed that I should say that to that young man. Let's have a positive attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we really do it with the Lord, that's exactly what this world needs.
Yeah. I struggle with this because on the one hand, it seems wrong to say, no, you continue to support, even when there's corruption and so forth. I'm not comfortable with that answer. And yet I think if at the first sign of trouble or corruption, all the quote-unquote good people leave, then somehow that doesn't seem right either. And you think of what happens with Samuel as he grows up in the temple. It's exactly what you said, Zdravko. He becomes an agent of change. In the midst of that corruption, here is a young boy who hears the voice of the Lord and says, eventually speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And God uses Samuel to bring about change. And I don't know if it's a question of balance, but remembering maybe those two things and just prayerfully in each situation, not to blindly support corruption, but yet to work for change in those situations.
I think, too, as our listeners may point out as well, is that in this regard, this is not simply, First Church of Jerusalem. This is the tabernacle. This is the sanctuary. There are no other options in their case. It's either you worship there or you don't. So the situations today are not 100%. Yeah.
Good point.
Accurate, but it's still a lesson to be drawn, I think.
Good point. This is just a little personal favorite here. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 2 verse 3, and I wanted to conclude with this. It's Hannah's prayer, and there's this phrase at the end of verse 3, the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. That choice of words to me is very meaningful. The Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. As I look at my own life, it seems that I've focused oftentimes on deeds that are somehow flashy, deeds that are noisy. But there's a different unit of measurement being used here by the Lord. The Lord weighs deeds. And it seems to me that some of the deeds that maybe I would be most excited about, or that I may even notice in other people, the more flashy kind of noisy deeds, the ones with glitter and all that, those may not be the deeds that are the heaviest deeds. And I like that, again, I like that imagery of the Lord weighing deeds. Thank you, Zdravko and Carl, for your participation. Thanks also to Susan Michael, our program engineer. And finally, thank you for listening in. For Good Word, this is Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.